This is I Am As Faithful As a Coral Reef, written by Black Cat and read by Flower Parish. This is a Star Wars fic, rated for teen and up audiences, featuring the relationship Banna Bremu / Arla Fett. Tagged, Alternate Universe, Canon Divergence, War, Angst, Hurt / Comfort, Marriage of Convenience, Childhood Sweethearts, Mentions of Wartime Suffering, Politics, and Mandalore Arla Fett. It's become a ritual at this point. Banna comes back from her bombed-out, starving world, aching and furious and raging. She lands and thanks the clones who escorted her, and then locks herself in her Senate office and doesn't come out until all the tears have burned themselves out over the course of a long, desperate night. Then, with the sun rising over Coruscant, she gets up, washes her face, cleans the ash off her skin as best she can, and goes to try and fix things the only way she knows how. Humbarin is in the core. The war shouldn't touch it. But the war is right on top of them, and everyone in the whole moon-damned Senate refuses to so much as send aid, even when Humbarin has been supplying them with warships and arms and everything they need for defense for years. Banna is sick of it, sick to death, sick and dying, but still trying. And every single sunrise hurts because it means another day has passed and she's failed. She understands, she thinks now, why planets join the Confederacy. Would never, because Humbarin is one of the systems that founded the Republic, has always been loyal, but she's screaming. And all that echoes back from the Senate is cold silence, and every single day, it feels a little more like going mad. This time, the trip back from Humbarin is even quieter, even grimmer than normal. Banna sits in the back of the Gar transport, leaning against the cold metal wall, and Thorn sits beside her, silent, ash all over his bright armor. Humbarin's crust is melting from the bombardments, and the whole planet is unstable. Banna can feel it all through her chest, a vast and empty aching that says her whole world is dying, and all she can think about is the lists she's going to have to start drawing up in her office, the deals and pleas and groveling that's going to come as she tries to find worlds her people can evacuate to. She'll do it, and without hesitation. Because that's the reason she was elected, but... Sorry, Senator, Thorn says quietly, just before the thump of landing makes Banna lift her head. Carefully, Banna draws her headscarf up a little more, dirt-stained fingertips light as she tries to keep the purple lace clean. Her family were all weavers and lacemakers, once. Humbarin was known for its shipyards, its technological sectors, but... its lace, too. The entire district where her family's shop used to be is gone now, wiped out, and Banna doesn't know if she feels grief at the knowledge that everything is lost forever, or relief that her aunts both passed on before they had to see 500 years of family history ripped apart in the space of an hour. "Thank you for accompanying me," she says, and doesn't let the words catch in her throat or tangle on the tears she's not going to allow herself. Not until she's in private. Obvious shows of grief will undermine her influence in the Senate, or what's left of it, and she can't afford any hesitation right now. Not when she needs to claw back some bit of the help that the Republic has entirely refused to offer, despite everything Humbarin has given. "I'm sorry that it was a wasted trip, Commander." Half of the government was killed in the last bombing. All the rest was too overwhelmed for any of the meetings she'd intended to hold, and it was a wasted trip. Humberin's senior senator digging through the rubble for hours on end, looking for survivors, until her clone security detail forcibly dragged her out of the district. That doesn't help anyone. Not on the scale they need to be helped. Thorne is silent for a long moment, then pushes to his feet, offering her a hand. It's such a small gesture, but Banna feels it ripple through her like the unsteady tremors racking Humberin's surface, and she swallows as she slides her fingers over Thorne's torn gauntlet. He squeezes tightly for a long moment before he lets go, and Banna can't breathe, can't speak for the knot in her throat. Bows her head instead, then steps past him, out the door of the transport, and down into the perfect, climate-controlled balminess of a Coruscant evening, the whole Republic humming along without pause. It really does feel like madness, Banna thinks, wiping her ash-stained hands off on her dress, even though the dress is ruined too at this point. 3 hours ago, she passed the body of a dead child back to their mother. She can still feel his cold weight in her arms. Coruscant feels like some terrible sort of dream, in comparison. Like being locked inside perfect white walls with smiling people, who will never acknowledge the fact that Banna hasn't eaten in days and is wearing silk turned gray and brown with the ashes of her world. "Senator," Thorne says suddenly, and Banna turns and looks back at him. He's hovering in the transport's doorway, helmet under one arm, dark eyes made even darker with the dark bruises of lack of sleep beneath them. He hesitates, and then asks, "Are you going to your office?" Banna inclines her head, tugs the lace headscarf up again when it wants to slip. Her hair feels greasy, unkempt. She needs to shower, but going home to the rich apartment high above the district feels so alien she can't quite comprehend it right now. "I have some work I need to see to before the day ends," she says, and it's nothing but the truth. Her people need her to find them refuge, to beg a place for them on other worlds, because Humberin is dying. It's the least she can do right now. "Did you require something, Commander?" Thorne shakes his head. "I think there's someone waiting to meet with you," he says, and it's quiet, pitched so as not to carry. The flicker of his gaze goes past Banna, towards the next closest person on the landing pad, but the port official is too far away to hear, no matter their heritage. "You might want to go there first." The very last thing Banna wants right now is to see another person, have to deal with other senators or government officials or well-meaning acquaintances. But something about Thorne's furtiveness strikes her, and she pauses, watching him. He's her usual escort, and he'd been more nervous than normal as they set out, angrier than normal as they returned. She caught him on a comm call once, all hissed voices and a sharpness that was unfamiliar against his usual easygoing cheer. Nothing she'd been able to press him about, not with her mind on her planet, but striking now in retrospect. Thorne knows her little bits of ritual. He wouldn't interrupt that without a reason. "I plan to head straight there," she promises, and Thorne smiles, wan but real. "Good," he says, and then, softer, "I really am sorry, Senator." Banna smiles back, thin and bare and pared right down to bone, then dips her head and turns, passing the approaching official without looking back, and heading down the long, straight lanes of the port. Her appearance earns her sideways glances as she steps aboard the public transit car, but she ignores them. The more reminders Coruscant gets about the reality of the war, the better, even if she has to carve it into her own skin to make them see. Humberin is only a few hours in hyperspace from Coruscant. Humberin spent all of its resources to protect the core, leaving no defenses for itself. The fact that anyone can justify looking away turns in Banna's stomach, and she closes her eyes, rests her temple against the cool metal of a handrail. Her staff should be with her, her chief aide and her personal assistant and her security officer, her legislative assistant and her deputies and speechwriters. They all stayed on Humberin, though. Most of them had family killed in the bombings or the tremors that followed, and there was nothing in Banna that could force them to leave. It's been almost 6 months since her sister was killed, and that was the last of her family. Banna would have put her duty to her people first regardless, but it makes it easier, almost, having no one now. Tears prickle behind her closed eyes, and Banna takes a breath, opens them so she won't cry. Not in public, she tells herself, and digs her nails into her palms. Not in private either, though, not for a while. Thorn said someone is waiting for her, and that means Banna needs to hold herself together at least through one more meeting. Then she can fall apart for as long as the night lasts. That will have to be enough. By the time she exits the tram, navigates the halls, greets a few people on the way to her office, Banna has dragged a little composure back by her fingernails, enough to make small talk with Bale in the lift. His eyes are worried as he watches her, but Banna keeps her chin raised, her spine straight, her eyes dry as she asks after the weather, the bill he's working on, his wife. Bale is a good friend, and he doesn't press, even though Banna knows he wants to. There's no one in the hall outside her main office when Banna approaches the door, and for a moment she pauses, some edge of wariness flickering. When the Separatists were trying to destabilize Humberin, early on in the war, there were plenty of assassination attempts, to the point that Commander Fox himself used to walk her to and from the Senate chambers. The attempts have tapered off now that Humberin is almost entirely destroyed, but some bit of instinct remains. Thorn was the one who told her to expect a visitor, though, and Banna doesn't believe he would try to have her killed. Maybe that's foolish, because he serves the Chancellor first and foremost, and Palpatine has certainly never cared to help Humberin in even the smallest of ways, but despite herself, Banna reaches out to the control pad, keys in her code. She trusts Thorn. They dug through the rubble together in her family's district, trying to scrape together what bits they could of her family's shop. That has to mean something at this point in the whole wretched war. The main room of her office is dark still. There's a bouquet of roses on the main desk, is the first thing Banna notices, because she hasn't been able to bring herself to buy flowers in months now. They used to fill the whole room, flowers from every planet she could source them from, but they died. During her trips back to her crumbling world, they all wilted and died, and Banna had come back to an office full of death and had almost broken down the moment she stepped inside. These roses are still fresh and perfect, though. A whole bouquet, lying on its side right in the center of the reception desk, wrapped up in midnight blue gauze. The flowers themselves are a soft lavender, petals curling into a pale, purple-touched cream at the edges, and Banna stares at them for a long moment, then steps close, reaching out to touch. The petals are as soft as silk, plush like velvet beneath her ashy fingertips, and Banna draws her hand back sharply, paranoia saying that she's going to ruin them. "Do you like them?" a woman asks, and deeper in the shadows, a figure shifts, rises. "I tried to look for something that would do you justice, but I think I fell short." Banna pauses, startled, the words taking a long moment to register. She curls her fingers against her palm, uncertainty rising, wariness following. "Forgive me," she says politely, "but may I ask why exactly you're bringing me flowers, if this is a proposition?" The woman steps into the shaft of light from the high window, and Banna's words die on her tongue. She's tall, broad-shouldered and muscular, with blonde curls pulled back in intricate braids and a long scar down one cheek. There's a blaster in a thigh holster, even though no one but the guard should be carrying a weapon like that inside the Senate, and she looks dangerous, Banna thinks, taking a half step back towards the door. Far too dangerous to be bringing a stranger flowers. "Not quite a proposition," the woman says, faintly rueful, and her smile is charmingly crooked. That accent is all broad vowels, familiar even though it's been years since Banna was last in Mandalorian space. She's always loved that accent, though. There was a girl once, when she was young and silly and fell in love easily, whose smile made it the loveliest sound in the galaxy. An offer, maybe. Banna stares at her for a long moment, then digs her nails into her palm and forces herself to take a breath. She's the senior senator from the Humberan sector, she tells herself. Strange meetings and odd requests are nothing new in politics. This one is just coming at an inopportune time where her self-possession is concerned. My apologies, she says, and finally waves the door shut behind her. It was a long flight, and I'm less alert than I had hoped. Would you like some caff? There's a pause, almost startled, and the Mandalorian woman cocks her head, brow rising. Thorne said you were helping with the rescue efforts, she says, even. That would tire anyone out. Banna doesn't let herself falter, just smiles as best she can. Pauses, then picks up the roses, breathing in the wash of sweet scent. She'd almost forgotten anything could be so vivid, she thinks, and brushes her fingertips over the petals again, unable to stop herself. She hasn't thought about flowers in months, but these truly are lovely, she thinks, and buries her face in them, even though it's unbecoming of her station. Breathes, closing her eyes, and feels the prick again, the burn of tears that want to come. Someone brought her flowers. She's covered in ash and blood and sweat, and a stranger went looking for flowers in her favorite color, picked them, brought them. It feels like such a large gesture right now that Banna can't quite bear it. There's movement near her, and a moment later, a hand finds Banna's, curls over her raw knuckles. If you like them, the woman says, soft, I'll bring you more. Banna tries not to let her breath shake. They're beautiful, she manages. She's going to cry. One little thing, and it's enough to break her composure. It's not fair. From Concord Dawn, the woman offers, and the weight of her eyes is almost tangible. She's watching, and Banna tries desperately to keep herself together beneath that steady stare. My mother bred the variety herself. Concord Dawn, Banna thinks, and that's enough to make her lift her head. You're Mandalorian, she says, thinks, despite herself, of a clear day in Kaldabi, strange and lush and colder than anything on Humberin, and a girl her age who saved her from pickpockets spent every sunny hour with her until night fell. Silly to think she fell in love with a stranger after a few hours, but it was her very first love, and Banna has never forgotten. It's a strange, bright, perfect memory against all the ash, and all the more precious for that. The woman smiles, turns her hand and takes Banna's, then lifts Banna's scraped raw knuckles to her lips. Arlafet, she says, and raises her head. The Mandalore. Banna blinks, startled. I thought Duchess Satine Kryze, she starts, and the face Arla instantly pulls is ridiculous enough to startle a ragged laugh right out of her throat. It's been so long since Banna laughed that she can't remember the last time. Duchess Kryze is the leader of the new Mandalorians, Arla says, though there's a flicker of warm satisfaction on her face, like making Banna laugh was her goal. She can call herself whatever she wants, but she is not the Mandalore. My people follow me. There's almost always unrest in Mandalorian space, and Banna hasn't paid attention to any news that doesn't concern her own planet recently. Still, missing the rise of a new Mandalore is something significant, and Banna hesitates, then shifts the roses to the crook of one arm, catches her torn dress, and dips a curtsy, the precise depth of a senator meeting a planetary leader. Mandalore Fett, she murmurs. I am Senator Banna Brimu of Humberin. It's an honor. There's a pause, and then Arla makes a sound of quiet amusement, catches her elbow, tugs her up without any ceremony. You've just spent all day digging through rubble, she says. How about I make you calf, and you sit down for a while? Banna blinks, but she doesn't resist as Arla steers her towards the spacious inner offices. You're going to make me my own calf, she asks, bemused. Assuming I can find it, Arla confirms agreeably. She guides Banna down on one of the overstuffed sofas, then pauses, sinks down to one knee, watching Banna with oddly familiar brown eyes, and says with a strange edge of gentleness, "I know no Republic forces have been deployed to help Humberin, but I have two cruisers and half a dozen medical ships waiting at the edge of Mandalorian space. They can be in your system in 3 days." Something jars through Banna, seismic. Her breath catches, and she grabs Arla's hands automatically, like she can pin her in place, pin the offer down as well. "You," she starts, and then her throat closes. That's an offer of help, an offer of defense, too, and Humberin is so deeply desperate for any military help, anything that won't leave them a perfect target every time Grievous decides to send his bombers through hyperspace and to their doorstep. The Gar has been pulled back, has given up. But two cruisers, Mandalorian pilots and fighters, they could save so many people. So impossibly many. And Banna feels her eyes sting, wraps Arla's hands in her own and clutches at them. "Please," she says, and the word shakes out of her, but she was prepared to grovel, to beg whoever she needed to, for however long was required, and get far, far less help. And this is hope. This is help already promised. "Mandalore, please. My people need every bit of help you're willing to offer. I..." She breaks off, the words shaking too much to finish, and something in Arla's expression twists, rueful and regretful and soft around the edges. "The help is yours," she says, and Banna has been a politician long enough to know what she's hesitating over. It takes a second to find her voice again, but the words themselves aren't hard. "Whatever conditions there are," she says, meeting Arla's eyes. Thorn's eyes, she thinks, in an unfamiliar face, and oh, one of those Fets, which just makes it all the more likely she's trouble. Squarely across the inches between them. "Regardless of what it is, if you're willing to offer aid, I'll accept. The Republic has abandoned them. There's nowhere else to go except the Huts, and their help costs far too much for war-ravaged Humberin." At this point, Banna is desperate enough to accept any conditions. There's a pause, and then Arla breathes out, slow, and smiles crookedly. "I want you to call for a vote of no confidence against the Chancellor," she says, and turns her hands in Banna's grip, gathering Banna's hands in her own and raising them to her mouth again. In the low light, her eyes are burning, a vicious, angry, razor-edged thing. Banna's breath catches. She has no idea how she didn't see it before, but Arla is furious here, on her knees in front of Banna's ash-stained feet. Her grip is gentle, though, and she breathes out against Banna's skin, golden lashes veiling the bloody fervor in her eyes as she smiles. "And then," she says, stroking her thumbs across Banna's palms, "I want you to take his seat, so that the Mandalore's wife controls the whole Republic." Banna stills. The flowers, she thinks, dragging her thoughts back into motion, and Thorn knowing about this visit. Arla got in with her blaster when security should have stopped her, but the security forces are all clones in the Senate building. A Fett, like Jango, and here for a purpose. "This is about the clones," she says. Arla wants the Chancellor deposed. It's a gamble, a terrible gamble, because any instability in the Republic is an invitation for the Separatists to gain ground, kill more troopers. Arla is the Mandalore, a warlord in all but name. She would know the tactical risk of changing leaders in the middle of a war. That means there's a reason pressing enough to force her hand, to make her accept that risk. "Something happened?" she asks, concerned, and Arla huffs. "Fox said you were quick," she says, smiling. It doesn't do anything to dampen the anger in her eyes. "All of my nephews have control chips in their heads. The Chancellor is the one holding the code to activate them. And when he does, he's going to turn the Republic into his own personal empire." Banna feels cold all through, and she pulls her hands away from Arla, wraps her arms around herself. can't even protest, though part of her wants to, because Palpatine has spent the years of the war gathering every emergency power the Senate will cede to him, and that's almost all of them. He controls the banks, the army, the Jedi, the courts. No one is allowed to so much as ask for peace talks with the Separatists, or they'll be charged with treason. It's already almost an empire, and Banna has seen the way so many other senators are caught up in it, in Palpatine's power and influence. They'd vote him into an empire without hesitation at this point, and she fears it more than almost anything. She's seen Palpatine's care for the worlds under him now, when he has to play at being a popular leader. Take that away, and the result, she thinks, will be 100,000 worlds that look just like Humberin. And with a whole army, chipped and controlled, endlessly loyal, without the honor and dignity that the clones have right now, everything would crumble. There aren't enough votes, she says, and the words should want to catch in her throat. Treason should be a harder thing to speak. Deposing the Chancellor in wartime is a fool's reckless act. Deposing him at the will of a Mandalorian ruler is even more rash. But Banna thinks again of Thorn, wavering in the doorway of the transport, looking so worried. Thinks of Arla's steady, "my nephews," and the rage in her eyes. It's not the expression of a warlord looking to conquer. That's the face of an aunt desperate to save her last surviving family. Banna swallows, thinking of the aunts who raised her, who died in the first bombing. She can't say that they wouldn't have done something equally desperate and devoted in the same kind of situation. Arla snorts. "I've got the votes," she says, and it's faintly bitter. "Every last corrupt bastard I could bribe or blackmail into agreeing. That's most of the Senate." It aches, even now, to hear that. Banna has been fighting that corruption for as long as she's been in the Senate, but it feels like trying to catch a waterfall in a bottle. If she were Chancellor, she thinks, and breathes in, her gaze flickering to the tangle of roses. A proposal, but Arla didn't have to bring them. Just offering aid would have been enough. "We're not married," she says, as steady as she can make it. Without hesitation, Arla draws one arm out of her coat, showing Banna the sleek black vambrace strapped over her shirt sleeve. "We exchange vambraces and we're married in Mandalorian tradition," she says. "There don't have to be witnesses, and the Senate recognizes Mandalorian weddings." She smiles, a little rueful. "I checked. You used to go to Mandalore when you were younger. We could have gotten married there, and you just didn't tell anyone, since you thought I was dead." Banna can't help a small sound, almost a laugh. "And once I become Chancellor, my presumed dead wife sweeps in, newly become Mandalore," she asks. It sounds like something out of a terrible romance novel. That likely means people will buy it, though. The public always loves a romance. She's thinking about this. She's planning for this. If it goes through, does that mean Mandalore will help the Republic seek peace? She asks, and reaches for Arla's hands again. "If you're willing to add your weight to the call for negotiations..." There's a pause, long, careful. "I thought," Arla says quietly, "that you'd want revenge for what happened to your planet." Banna closes her eyes, feels the sting again, the burn of tears. "I've never wanted that," she says, soft. "All I want is for the fighting to stop." Arla ghosts a hand up her arm, her shoulder, cups her face, leans in, and Banna can't help the way her breath catches when Arla gently kisses away the tear that slips down her cheek. It shakes through her, that one vast motion, and she slides a hand up, grips Arla's vambrace. The metal is cool and almost liquid slip beneath her fingertips, beautiful and finely made. Arla's larger than her, far more muscular and with a sturdy build, but Banna wears draping sleeves, long and flowing in the Humberin fashion. They'll hide the vambrace if she wears it. When she wears it. "Good," Arla says. "That's what I want, too." She settles back, unbuckling the armor, and then takes Banna's hand and looks up, meeting her eyes. Some of the deadly edge has faded, and she looks worn now, exhausted in a way Banna is all too familiar with. "I will help your world," she says, reaching up to touch the edge of Banna's straight dark hair beneath the purple lace. "I know what it's like to have your whole planet glassed. Even if things fall through, you have my word that I'll help." Banna's throat feels tight, and she reaches out, curls her hands over Arla's. "And mine," she says, "my word that I'll help your nephews. The Gar won't need to exist once the war is over, and then we can give the clones everything we owe them for what they've done for us." "Those sound like Mando enough vows for me," Arla says, a little rough, and clasps the cool metal around Banna's forearm, tightening the straps gently. There are roses etched into the surface of it, Banna realizes, pale, delicate lines covering the metal, filling the armor with flowers, and she presses her fingertips to them, then smiles. "On Humberin," she says quietly, "we would exchange flowers under the full moon, but that can be for after," Arla says, "once you've rebuilt." She smiles. After the whole galaxy knows that the Mandalore defeated death itself to reunite with her wife again, after decades lost and apart. Banna laughs a little, reaching up to wipe her eyes. Help, she thinks. Help is coming, and she can offer help in return. "The Silkweaver's niece and the Warrior Woman?" she asks, and Arla grins, bright and warm. "The Silkweaver's niece and the Deathwatch assassin," she corrects, even more dramatic. She lifts Banna's hands again, kisses her knuckles, and this time it lingers, deliberate. "Deathwatch assassin," Banna thinks, startled, and stills. She stares at Arla for a moment, and once, on Mandalore, she'd met a girl in Kel'Dabi. A pretty girl, with haunted eyes but a sweet smile, who saved her from pickpockets and spent all day with her, laughing and wandering the streets and holding her hand. A girl with blonde hair and a Death Watch tattoo on her shoulder, like a brand of ownership, a tattoo she didn't like to look at or talk about, but a kindness despite all the pain that has always lingered, always made Banna want to be better, to push for peace no matter what. It's been a bright memory for decades, an old dream. But the dream is right in front of her, older and more worn and more beautiful than ever. "Your name wasn't Arla then," Banna says, and the words catch in her throat. She's looked for the girl a dozen times, but the name never led anywhere, and she'd thought. Arla's smile is crooked, almost painful. "It was always Arla," she says, "but Tor gave me a new name I had to use." She pauses, and then leans forward, dropping her forehead against Banna's fingers. Stays there for a long moment, just breathing, and then says, "When Thorn told me your name, it was like the whole universe was meant for this moment. I think you saved me that day, and now I can finally save you in return." A sound shakes out of Banna's chest, part sob, part laugh. She's covered in ash and blood, married to her first love, a girl she'd thought was dead. They're sitting in her darkened office, with roses spilling all around them, and they're plotting to overthrow the Republic, to save it. The very first person Banna ever loved is here, and she's offering help, and Banna has never stopped loving her, no matter how many years have passed. "It's always been you," she manages, and she's crying, but not alone, not this time. And Arla pulls Banna down into her lap, wraps her up in her arms, and kisses away the tears. The end.